You're the one in the middle the other day.
Going to open the House Ag and Natural Resources Committee. Today is March 30th, 2017. Folks, for those in the audience who are not here on House Bill 3226, let me explain the rest of the agenda because we have lots of people here. So we are not going to be hearing today House Bill 3338, which has to do with gas stations, because our main person to talk about it isn't here. And so I think maybe our DOJ person can be excused and not have to sit through other bills, because we're not getting to that today. The is Representative Hayden here? I think he probably already knows this, but I don't think we're going to get to the it's about contractors and forest land. House Bill 3006, so we'll carry House Bill 3006 over. We have a short work session that I think needs to also carry over. Is that right? Our work session. I don't know. Oh, we don't have paperwork, Mark.
Okay.
We don't have paperwork. So let me carry over the work session on House Bill 2566. Okay, so that leaves us two left, and we've got a lot of people here on 3226. So we're going to quickly go and take our public testimony on House Bill 3245, because I know at least somebody came in on their day off to be here. Otherwise, I would carry that one over, too. So let me open a public hearing on House Bill 3245 and ask Tess and Dan Atchison. And if you have one more that you're thinking, there's a list here, but I don't know who's part of your panel, Tess. And I don't see Tess either.
Let me go. So she's here. We have a carryover.
I'm trying to get to the overflow room now to see if we can summon our witnesses. This is going to be very compressed, and then we'll come back to some of these other witnesses another day. But the people who came from a distance to be here, we're going to take their testimony, and then we're going to pause, and we'll take it up another day, because we got lots of people here on the other bill. So go ahead. Tell us about this one.
Thank you. Chair Clem, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tess Milio, here on behalf of the City of Salem in support of House Bill 3245. So I'm joined today by Salem City Attorney Dan Atchison, and he's going to talk about the bill in detail and the benefits.
Not much detail.
All right, we'll keep it short.
Yeah, explain the basic concept, and we will have this whole hearing again another day.
Oh,
but the people
okay.
who came here today who took their day off, they should talk, and then we will come back another day and repeat this all over again.
Sounds good. All right. Well, then I will just let him get right to it
yeah.
at that point.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Vice Chairs, and members of the committee. My name is Dan Atchison, Salem City Attorney. Very quickly, this is a very simple bill that allows cities the option of having their quasi-judicial comp plan map amendments decided by the Planning Commission or Hearings Officer, as opposed to the current requirement, which requires the City Council to make that final decision. There is existing authority in ORS 227 that allows cities' planning commissions to do anything that's necessary and proper to carry out their functions. We had been relying on that authority. A 2015 LUBA case changed that and said, no, the City Council must make that final decision and must do it by ordinance. That has required the City of Salem and other jurisdictions to extend that process out, and now takes the City of Salem about 60 to 90 days longer to issue those decisions than previously. So for us, it's very difficult, and it extends the process out. It makes the cost to the city higher. It makes the cost to the participants higher to have the City Council make that decision. So process-wise, it goes to the Planning Commission for a recommendation. Then it goes to City Council for a final decision. Most times there's two hearings. There's a lot of costs associated with both of those hearings. There's also an ordinance required at the end. For us, that requires two readings, and that extends the process out another 30 to 60 days. Plus, those ordinances can't be effective for another 30 days. So as far as cost to the applicant and a cost to their development, which oftentimes is multifamily development, it requires them to have to pay for those extra costs, and it requires the city to have extra staff and extra process involved in it. By streamlining it with this bill, we have the Planning Commission or the hearings officer make the final decision. We've been doing this for several years. I've been with the city for about 10 years, and they were doing it prior to my arriving there, so we've been doing it for a long time. We have seldom had an issue with that. For the city of Salem, we allow folks to appeal these decisions to the city council. So if there's a concern about city councils being involved in this policy sort of decision, it's very easy for someone to go to the city council and seek that appeal. In addition, most jurisdictions have a call-up or a review procedure for their city council. So the city councils on their own motion can review this Planning Commission decision to decide whether it's the right thing to do. There's been some opposition in the written testimony regarding the sanctity of the comprehensive plan, that only city councils should have the authority to make that decision. This is not a text amendment. We're not changing the policies of the plan. We are just changing a small, discrete area of the map. So a 1 or 2 acre property, 1 or 2 property owners, that's usually a single property, wants to go from a commercial designation to a residential designation. They've got to go in and change that map. There's specific concrete criteria that apply to those decisions. And in the city of Salem, at least, we feel the Planning Commission, who are trained and have expertise in land use matters and know how to apply criteria to specific applications, is a much better forum to have those decisions made, as opposed to a city council where they're pulled in different directions. They see different issues come before them every day. They don't have that land use expertise. So for those reasons, we think it's a great bill. It's very simple. And we think it lowers the cost for the city. It lowers the cost for the participants. And it results in a quicker, cheaper decision for everybody involved.
Okay, Representative Helm, as you can tell, everyone's here to just talk about your bill on comp plan amendment. No, just kidding. Everyone's here to talk about a different bill, so we're asking you all to quickly describe this. We will come back and have a more thorough discussion another day, but we wanted to get at least a little summary today, and then we'll come back.
Mr. Chair, Ken Helm, State Representative for House District 34. You know, there are some people who think that comprehensive plan and zoning is really exciting.
Yeah. Okay, that would be you, and that's pretty much it.
Must be the Planning Commission.
Yeah. So, members of the committee, Ellen Miller, representing the city of Salem, came to me right about just a bit before the session started and said, hey, we've got this problem. Can you help me with it? And that's so I agreed to put in a bill to address this issue because I thought it was one that could be solved.
And can you remind some of us of your background and why it might make sense that they would have asked you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I've been a land use attorney for over 20 years, and I practice in all areas. So I've been a developer's attorney, an opposition attorney. I've worked as a government attorney for Metro, for my client, Representative McLean. In the last 8 years until recently, I've been a hearings officer for up to six jurisdictions in the state. So I deal with this stuff. And I've appeared before planning commissions, and I appeared before county commissions and city councils. One of the techniques that's used out there that I thought the bill might get at is one that's used in Deschutes County, where I was hearings officer for many, many years. And that is, you could have a hearings officer decision on a number of things, including a plan amendment if you wanted to. And then there's two different routes you could take. One, an appeal could be made to the county commission. The county commission could simply rubber stamp it and send it off to LUBA without doing anything. And that gives all the parties that were interested a direct route to LUBA. Or the county commission could say, okay, we're interested in this. We want to put our full imprint on it, and we're going to hold full hearings. Those types of techniques allow both the applicant, the local government, and all the interested parties an equal opportunity to weigh in without compromising the public process. This bill may need a little bit more work to kind of get to that. And there, I will acknowledge, we're weighing a couple of different big public policy values here. One is the value on public input and the ability to appeal land use decisions that the community may feel are not in their best interest. And the other is administrative efficiency for the cities and counties. One thing, or in the cities in this case, one thing I think you would be well served to consider here is that there are differences in planning commissions across the state. And we ask planning commissions to do a number of different jobs. And truth be told, there are different capabilities of a planning commission. They're not uniform. So it could be a different world in Warrenton, for example, versus the city of Salem. And also intertwined in this is we've allowed cities and counties to impose fees and fee schedules on appeals. And you may be aware that there is a lot of controversy out there because some cities and some counties have decided that they're going to charge extraordinary appeal fees. They're, in fact, in my opinion, outrageous, in order to chill the public process, essentially. That's not the case in Salem at all, and I don't think it's the case in Happy Valley. But when we set up these mechanisms by which we're requiring an appeal to a city council, that's got to be, and there is a local appeal fee, that's got to be a factor. So I'm glad you're going to return and chew on this a little bit. I think it's a good kernel of an idea, and I think with a little bit of massaging here, you could probably get to something that works for all of the cities in the state.
Okay, great. Who was our person who, I thought it was Happy Valley maybe, who, and then, but you're not Happy Valley. Sorry, that's who I was aiming for you to bring with you, so I'll excuse you.
Brian,
yes.
Can I ask a quick question of the city while they're here?
We're going to have a whole other hearing on this topic again, and all these other people here on another bill, so I think we're just going to try and move past it and do questions the next day.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep. But I did do this whole thing just so the Happy Valley people. So could I have the Happy Valley person come up?
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like we better give one opponent a chance, too, so it doesn't seem completely biased. So Mary Kyle, if you're around somewhere, could you come up, too? And again, we're going to have another hearing on this another day. So just tell us a little bit so we didn't waste your whole day here, and then we'll move on.
All right, good morning, Chair Clem and Vice Chairs and committee members. My name is Jason Tuck, City Manager of Happy Valley. The reason we're here is because of a LUBA appeal that remanded one of our decisions because we authorized our Planning Commission to make decisions on comp plan amendments and zone changes for properties less than 20 acres, and that's kind of a key, very small properties. So on behalf of the city, we'd like to express our support for your support of this bill. Just a little bit more background. Happy Valley is the fastest growing city in the state and has been for a number of years now. So growth is going to continue and be accelerated with our annexation of areas that were formerly Damascus. Yeah. We've already annexed close to 1,000 acres of that property, and we're going to continue. So having the authority for our Planning Commission to make decisions on these small parcels that may need some adjustment is efficient for us and works very well. In practice, many development applications are paired with our comprehensive plan and amendments and zone changes. And so the Planning Commission gets the ability to look at what that looks like on the ground by having the development application paired with that versus just a straight-up zone change. And we'd like to continue their ability to do that. I'll just cut to the chase here. Under current state law, counties are permitted to delegate this authority, but cities are not. Now, because of this LUBA case, this dual requirement for cities and counties is confusing to developers, and we would like to level the playing field here. basically at its core, House Bill 3245 isn't a local mandate, but it simply gives city councils the ability to delegate some of that authority if they wish to. So thank you for your time, and we hope that you support this bill.
Okay. Really quick second Happy Valley person.
Thank you, Chair Clem, members of the committee. My name is Chris Crane. I'm the city attorney for the city of Happy Valley. I'm also a land use lawyer. I've been practicing for more than 20 years. Representative Clem and I were baby lawyers together and worked together over the years. So stuff is near and dear to my heart. I will point out that when this went up to LUBA, the opponents relied on old line of county cases that achieved the same result. Like LUBA said that if it's a comp plan map amendment, it has to be approved by the county board. And the legislature responded in 1987 by adopting a statute that is now ORS 215.431. And if you look at the statute and you change the word county to city, you get exactly House Bill 3245. So what the cities are asking for here is exactly the authority that was given to the county 30 years ago, and the sky has not yet fallen. Nor has anybody complained about lack of access or accountability as a result of ORS 215-431. Moreover, this doesn't affect most cities because the vast majorities of cities in the state have a different zoning map and comp plan map. They can change the zoning from, in this case, the Happy Valley case, it was a four-acre parcel going from one high-density residential zoning designation to another high-density residential zoning designation. But because we have one map that's both a comp plan map and the zoning map, every zone change is also a comp plan amendment. For the vast majority of cities in the state, that's not the case. They have a different zone map. You can amend the zone map all you want without affecting your comp plan map, so it never comes up. So this is really a very small bill. It affects the small minority of cities in the state that have what's called a single map system, and simply puts us on par, brings us back in line with the vast majority of cities that have a two map system, and every one of Oregon's 36 counties. Again, the legislature adopted this bill for counties 30 years ago, and the sky has not fallen. So we're just asking for the same sort of planning system that affects the rest of the state for the small cities like Salem and Happy Valley that have a single map system. Thank you.
Okay, great. So, Mayor Cowell, just give us a little flavor of what the opposition looks like, and then we'll come back and revisit this again another day.
Good morning, Chair Clement, members of the committee. Mary Kyle McCurdy, representing 1,000 Friends of Oregon. I'd like to just endorse the comments of Representative Helm. As he said, there's a couple of issues here, but the most important one for us is, in order for anyone, whether it's opposition or the developer, to get a final decision out of a local government that could be appealable to the Land Use Board of Appeals, they have to go to the City Council, and that can be cost prohibitive. In talking to people I work with across the state, some think the planning commissions do better than their city councils. Some think their city councils do better than their planning commissions, and that's including talking to affordable housing developers who it's all over the place. I don't think this should be an issue about forum shopping. I think it should be an issue about a good public process to get a final decision out of the local government body. And if the fee to go from an appeal from a planning commission to a city council is cost prohibitive, and that has been a big issue in the county system that Chris Crane just described, that's a problem. That's a problem for small developers. It's a problem for people who might not like the particular development, and it's just not good public process. So it sounds to me like there is a system in Deschutes County that might be workable if the fee isn't prohibitive to get that final decision out of a local government quickly. We'd all like a quick decision, but I think this should be about a good process, one that isn't cost prohibitive and throwing up fee barriers to public participation at the local government level in a significant thing like a plan, a comprehensive plan. Thank you.
So just to clarify something, and maybe we can save ourselves a lot of pain, if we had a little group that talked about the fee issue, theoretically there's not a major problem with having discussions at the planning that could be called up. It's that will usually trigger a fee. If there weren't a fee when it got pulled up, then would it be a non-issue largely for
many,
just the venue issue?
Chair Clem, for many of the people I was talking to, that is the main problem. I think I'd appreciate hearing the wisdom of more in-depth from Representative Helm on the his experience as a hearings officer, because he mentioned, I don't know, the way in which Deschutes County works with the two-track system. So,
okay, we'll come back to this a whole other day.
Thank you
all for giving us a little pricey. Let me close the public hearing on House Bill 3245. Carry over the public hearing on House Bill 3245 and get to our main event that everybody's here for, which is House Bill 3226. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3226. Find Representative Holvey. There he is, waiting in the wings, just as hoped for. Please join us. Okay. Do you want to have the other three join you? So we need to figure out a chair.
I'll be very short if you could have Greg Hallard come
Okay,
up.
Greg Hallard, Ernie Neamey, and then...
what is
that? Can I ask what that device is?
It is a 3D camera.
I think they're filming everything on this.
I'm not
if
sure you can do
I don't
that.
Think you need a camera because they're...
Well, we're going to... It's a University
Excuse me?
Of Oregon project.
We
Okay.
University of Oregon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I had nothing to do with that.
Okay. This is kind of weird, but that's fine. We'll get used to it. It's just new. It's new, and we're not used to it. Okay, Representative Holvey, tell us what we need to know.
Thank you, Chair Clem, committee members. For the record, Paul Holvey, State Representative, District 8, out of South Eugene and South Lane County. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this. I think, you know, I've introduced this bill because of, you know, concerns I hear from constituents about Forced Practices Act. We've struggled meeting the coastal management zone requirements under the EPA, and it costs the state money. We lose money when we don't meet those requirements. And so that's a concern. Another concern of mine is I've spent a lot of time with the Siuslaw Law National Forest looking at forest practices, and just really I'm concerned about the quality of our watersheds and that habitat. When we look at those sorts of things, and we look at water temperatures especially, are really damaging to our fish. If we can't have cool enough waters. And, I think this is a big debate, of course, and I think it's a conversation that needs to happen, and that's why I brought this bill forward at the request of Pacific Rivers. And I just think that's something the state needs to take a stronger look at when I compare the Forest Practices Act in Oregon compared to Washington and other places. I think that we need to protect our habitat better than what we're doing. And I'll just sort of leave it at that and let you got a lot of people to testify on both sides of this issue. And I will just leave it at that and let the conversation go and let the people who have been working on this answer the questions.
Okay, thank you for joining us. Okay, so here's the plan. This panel, you've got about 15 minutes, and that's more than future panels will get, except the next one who's on the other side. So 15 minutes and 15 minutes to kind of walk us through pro and con. Then we're going to get a little informational. We'll have a second in favor panel of about 9 minutes. Then actually the other side was willing to waive their right to have a longer period for the next one. We're going to ask ODF to come up and take a couple questions on some topics. Then we'll just go into the sign-up sheet. So we'll take a little bit longer now to have you do it. But not everyone's getting 5 minutes, just the first couple panels. Otherwise, we'll be here till 10 tonight. So please.
Thank you, Chair Clem. Vice Chairs and members of the committee. My name is Greg Haller. I'm the Conservation Director for Pacific Rivers. We're about a 30-year-old organization that's been working for the conservation of rivers. Clean water and drinking water across the Oregon and throughout the region on both private and federal lands. Here to testify in support of House Bill 3226, and I appreciate Representative Holvey introducing it to start this important conversation. Why do we need to reform the Oregon Forest Practices Act? Well, the real reasons are quite simple, and I'll list six of them. Oregonians cherish healthy rivers and robust fish and wildlife populations for hunting, fishing, wildlife viewing. People move to Oregon because they believe it is a green state with progressive laws that protect the environment while supporting a sustainable timber industry.
The reality is much different. The intent of this bill is not to demonize loggers, logging, or small family foresters. The bill is a direct response to the actions of industrial timber owners and their stranglehold on the ability of Oregonians to implement change, either through the legislature or through the Board of Forestry. The current forest practice law is over 45 years old, and while there have been administrative updates, forest practices in Oregon are not based on the best available science. Our neighboring states and federal land managers recognized this fact years ago and have updated their forestry regulations to better protect the environment, and the timber industry is quite profitable in those states. The economic landscape has changed. Historically, most timber companies were owned by Oregon families. Today, most industrial timber companies are owned by large investment banks, insurance companies, and other multinational corporations, delivering their profits to out-of-state Wall Street investors. Oregon essentially subsidizes Wall Street with weak environmental protections, leaving Oregonians to bear the costs passed on to them through dirty drinking water, chemical contamination, cleanup of landslides, and threatened fish and wildlife populations. There's increasing demand for sustainably harvested wood, and the development of new wood-based building materials like cross-laminated timber will open Oregon's timber supply to new markets. This bill will accelerate the development of these new markets. The current law creates liability exposure to landowners from lawsuits brought under the Endangered Species Act. Current forest practices on private lands have contributed to the decline of fish and wildlife species, resulting in ESA protection for coho, northern spotted owl, and marbled murrelet. Mature and old-growth forests have all but disappeared from private lands. The bulk of the habitat supporting fish and wildlife is located on federal lands. There is no conceivable way that we will ever recover threatened species until we restore some percentage of private lands into real forests and adequately protect streams and rivers with appropriate streamside buffers and a reduced road network. Climate change. Oregon is not immune from the effects of climate change. In fact, Oregon's currently available cold water habitat, the streams and rivers that produce our salmon and steelhead and trout fisheries, is predicted to shrink drastically this century. If we do not expand buffers on all streams, fish-bearing or otherwise, we risk losing salmon and trout populations, a major economic component of the state's GDP and a culturally important species to Native American tribes and others. The Board of Forestry has proven itself unable or unwilling to modernize forest practices. The current riparian rulemaking starkly illustrates this point. The Department of Forestry, to its credit, showed that buffers of at least 100 feet were necessary to meet the requirements of the Clean Water Act. Instead, the board adopted rules that fell far short, expanding buffers by a mere 10 to 20 feet, far less than what is necessary to maintain cold water habitat in the affected streams. Making matters worse, the board exempted Southwest Oregon from the rule, and buffers in Oregon are still far smaller than our neighboring states. Current law also does not protect Native American cultural sites, which is a large oversight. So what this bill won't do, you'll hear testimony that this bill is a job killer, that it is a regulatory overreach, that it will require additional time and expense to plan and conduct timber operations, or that it will shut down logging completely. You will hear testimony that everything is just fine on private lands, our laws are sound, and we replant trees. Just ask the Oregon Forest Resources Institute, a quasi-government agency that uses millions of dollars that industry used to pay in property taxes to support the communities it operates in, but now goes to OFRI to develop propagandized commercials for television and radio, essentially telling you to move along, nothing to see here. This greenwashing is a sham, and Oregons know and deserve better. What this bill will do. This bill represents a vision for private lands forest management, is a starting point for a conversation of how we restore Oregon as a leader in sustainable forestry and conservation. The bill attempts to strike a balance between providing necessary flexibility to ensure timber owners can manage their investments profitably. It incentivizes practices that will monetize ecosystem services like restored fish and wildlife habitat and clean drinking water that will bring added value to landowners.
Greg, I just want to make sure, you know, you're cutting into the other guy's time. If that's part of the plan, no problem, but you're at 5:30 now.
So. Okay, I'll just wrap up here. A couple of the points that the bill will do. Forest management plans will provide transparency and accountability to all affected stakeholders. Streamside buffers will be expanded. Industrial landowners will be required to restore a portion of their lands to natural forests. Prohibitions on clear-cut logging on sites with high landslide risk will reduce the likelihood of an OSO-like disaster. And the aerial application of herbicides and drinking water sources as identified by ODEQ will be prohibited. We're not alone in thinking that the OFPA is out of date. Federal agencies, which have withheld funding from Oregon due to its weak forestry laws, other states, small landowners, and Oregonians know that reform is necessary. The question of reform is not if, but when. Thank you for allowing me to testify in support of this important legislation.
Okay, then I've got Ernie.
Thank you, Chairman Clem. Members of the committee, my name is Ernie Neamy. I'm president of a consulting firm in Eugene called Natural Resource Economics. I have worked for the industry, for local governments, and as a consultant on timber management or forest management issues for about 40 years in the state of Oregon. If we could move the slides forward, because we didn't actually get it, really important, that one right there. The one back. There. This slide shows information, a map prepared by the Environmental Protection Agency that shows the outlook for cold water fish, that is to say salmon, steelhead, and trout in the state of Oregon, if climate change is not brought under control very quickly. And basically you see a map that is blue, where most of Oregon supports these fish, going to red, where the state of Oregon would not support these fish. Go forward, please. One more. One more. Keep going, please.
You missed a bunch of them.
There. We have known as economists for a very long time that timber is an important product that comes off of our forests. We also have known that there are other products and services that come from these forests that are much more valuable. This graph shows research that was completed about 20 years ago. If you go from the left, the fifth block over is raw materials. That's where timber is, part of raw materials. There are other services that come from our forests in terms of climate regulation, waste treatment. That includes cleaning up our air, cleaning up our water, food production and recreation that are far more valuable. What we see with current practices in the state of Oregon is that very often industrial production that focuses on producing timber diminishes the value of these other goods and services that come from the forest. Next slide, please. This illustrates work that was conducted at the Oregon State University. It basically shows what happens in two basic alternatives. The upper set of lines is what happens if you conserve forests, if you allow the trees to grow, and you see that it stores carbon. It stores an awful lot of carbon. However, if you start to convert those forests to industrial timber production, you lose carbon off of that. Research conducted by the Bureau of Land Management over the last couple of years, plus an awful lot of research on the economic value of carbon emissions and the value of carbon stored on forests, indicate that the difference between those two scenarios, the value of the carbon is $300,000, perhaps $400,000 in the value of the carbon. In order to get timber, measured in tens of thousands of dollars. So in terms of overall welfare, health, and safety, we are giving up a tremendous amount of value in order to get a small amount of value. Next slide, please. So where we should be using the resource, the forest capability in the state of Oregon, which is the premier place in the world to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. Instead of doing that, we are emitting some of the highest levels of carbon dioxide from timber harvest in the United States. Next slide, please. We also are harming the water resources of the state of Oregon. We heard Representative Holder talk about the value of water resources here. This is a map that comes from the Environmental Protection Agency using data from the USGS. It shows that for most of the state of Oregon, more than one half of the surface water that becomes drinking water comes off of these streams that are intermittent or temporary. These are the lands that get logged the heaviest. And so in Greg's slides, those are the lands that are affected most. the value of the reduction in stream flow. And again, research at Oregon State University published last year indicates that the industrial production of timber on these lands reduces stream flow by about 50%. Now, we hear the argument that we have to log in order to have sustainable economic development in the state of Oregon, and that, in fact, is not true. Next slide, please.
And, Ernie, I just want to make sure you know you're a minute into our last friend's time.
Okay, I'm going to go very quickly.
Okay. Or if he can cut it back, that's okay. I just want you to manage it yourselves, please.
Very quickly. This slide shows that the number of jobs per unit of timber, per acre, in effect, is going down. The next slide. This shows that jobs in the timber industry have been declining for more than 30 years. Next slide. This shows that wages for the workers that remain in this industry have been going down, and very soon we should expect that wages in this industry will be about the average for the state as a whole. Next slide, please. The current industrial and regulatory structure will not fix this. This slide shows the amount of land in the state of Oregon that is owned by Wall Street organizations that have no interest whatsoever except in short-run profits from timber production. Those people are not concerned about the spillover costs we've been talking about. They will not be concerned about that unless we have a regulatory structure in this state that will fix that. But as Greg described, the Streamside Protection Rule, ORS 527.714 paren 7 paren, requires the Department of Forestry, the Board of Forestry, to prepare a, quote, comprehensive analysis of the economic impacts. If you look at the economic analysis that they prepared, there is not a word, not a single word, on any of these economic impacts that I just described, or that I described in more detail in my written testimony. Thank you very much.
Okay, welcome. Two and a half minutes. I'm going to give you a little extra. Okay.
Good morning, Chairman Clem and members of the committee. My name is Richard Chasm. I live about 25 miles outside of Roseburg and about 1,500 feet into Representative Brock Smith's district. I live on 66 acres of timberland that my father bought in 1958. I've worked in the woods, worked in the mills. I was commercial fishing for a while in the early 70s and saw the damage being done to the spawning runs, so I came back to Roseburg and started planting trees. The argument that we always hear is, what do you want? Do you want money in the economy, or do you want a pristine environment? I would submit that this is a false choice, that there are better ways to log than clear cutting. I've been doing it on my property. I submitted an extensive written statement to you in a comparison of the economies of selective harvest to clear cut logging. When you clear cut, you've removed all your options. When you selectively harvest, you haven't damaged the other resources and the real estate value. I forgot to mention I'm a licensed realtor since 1992. So my statement is there. In conclusion, there's a lot of talk, and you're going to hear a lot of talk today. But there's a thing known as ground truth. And that's what's actually happening out there. These photos of these clear cuts are devastating. I would advise and encourage you to go out and physically visit some of these. If you got a friend with a plane, fly over the Coast Range and take a look at what's actually happening out there. As a real estate agent, I can tell you that Oregon is famous for our natural beauty, our forests, our rivers, our timber, and our fish. And that is being jeopardized by these out-of-state corporations. I've seen them in Douglas County. But there's another reality, too, and that the climate is changing. I can see it on my own property in the Umpqua. The trees, the Doug fir on the sunny side of the slopes are dying. But I have trees that cast their own seed, so I've got pine and cedar coming in on their own without any expense to the landowner. But here's what's really going on out in the woods. This is a J root. A tree to grow needs to have these roots pointing straight down, but too many of the seedlings that are put on the ground are stuffed in there. When we have wet winters like this, this tree will live. But when we have a dry summer, this tree will die. And there's no other trees coming in out there besides what's planted. The natural reforestation is going to be far more successful in a situation where the climate is changing.
And just you're a minute over your panel's time, so there's a lot more people
it.
Here again, so I'm going to give you a little extra.
I hope you read my statement. It's long, but the end has got a number of suggestions and proposals. I actually feel pretty positive about this. We do need to start this discussion, and there are solutions. There are things that we can do to keep the mills and the workers working and the rivers flowing and the fish in the water and people coming to Oregon, because this is one of the finest places on planet Earth to live. I thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming up. You're going to get a few extra seconds here to add on, because one member has a question, and then when the next panel comes up, we'll do a couple questions. But as I've reminded my vice chair, questions cut into everybody else's time, so keep them short, please.
Ow. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just one question. Got a whole bunch, but I'm only going to ask you one. In reading the bill, the whereas clauses, and I want to focus our attention now to some facts and to some science. I've heard a whole lot of adjectives and flaming adjectives, both in testimony and the whereas statements. So what I want to talk about is, you have a whereas statement here, the Forest Practices Act has changed little in over 30 years, and existing protections of public resources under the OFP Act fall well below the standards. Can you give me an example? It says here it's changed very little in over 30 years, and I've got a document from Department of Forestry that shows lots of changes. So talk to me about the disparity in those two facts.
Well, I think the reality is that the management paradigm on the landscape has changed very little. Specifically, our riparian buffers, they have been tweaked, if you will, but the kind of substantial change that is necessary to not only meet the legal requirements of the Clean Water Act, but to protect our fish, to restore large wood to the stream channel, to deliver gravels and sediments. Those types of rules have not significantly changed. We still, for example, don't require buffers on the small non-fish-bearing streams. So that would be one example.
So it's less about, it's changed a little over 30 years. You disagree maybe with some of the changes, because I'm looking at like 25, 30 changes here to the Oregon Forest.
So one thing we're going to do is have ODF come up, and I think we could ask about, because actually I'm not even sure what can be changed by legislature and what can be changed by board. And I think it would be helpful for us to know, because I know I've been here 11 years and don't remember voting on any bills about it, but that doesn't mean the board doesn't take it up. And so I think we can talk about that with Peter when he comes up. Okay, thanks so much. Okay, let's switch to the other side now. Heath Curtis, Susan Watkins. Oh. So you two can divide your 15 minutes, be 7.5 each, or however you want. Actually, you can have about 16 now, since you're giving up your next 9-minute panel, you can have an extra minute to catch up. Okay, I'm starting your timer. Please.
Well, maybe we can get it started first.
Okay.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Heath Curtis, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Forest Industries Council. OFIC represents Oregon's large forest landowners and most of our state's forest product manufacturers. More than that, OFIC is one of many voices speaking on behalf of the over 60,000 Oregonians working in the timber industry in Oregon. I appear before you as one of them, and in strong opposition to House Bill 3226, a bill introduced at the request of Pacific Rivers and the Center for Sustainable Economy. So, House Bill 3226. There's a lot a guy could say about it. From its patently false and, frankly, comically inflammatory recitals to its proposed state takeover of private forest land management in Oregon, have it on good authority that this is the most anti-timber bill to ever appear before this body. But I don't think this is about House Bill 3226. If it were, I think the bill would be a little more measured and drafted more carefully. Instead, this appears to be, to us, to be one piece in a larger public relations campaign targeting the Oregon timber industry. That campaign was initiated in 2015 when three initiative petitions were filed with the state that would have severely regulated a variety of forest practices in Oregon. While none of those initiatives qualified for the ballot, the campaign itself didn't wane. Because the bill proponents have been particularly vocal in the last couple months, we have a pretty good handle on their primary messaging. You've heard some of it already today, and you'll hear more of it following Susan and me. They have two principal theses. The first is that the Oregon timber industry is damaging the environment and drinking water. And the second is that the industry is no longer relevant to the Oregon economy. Both are untrue. First, with respect to the environment, again, there's a lot to say, and the 10 minutes allotted to me wouldn't do it justice. But the good news is that you've already heard the truth. On January 6, 2014, Dr. George Ice and Dr. Arnie Skogset appeared before this very committee, alongside Liz Dent with the Department of Forestry and Mike Clousey with the Oregon Forest Resources Institute. They spoke to you about the cutting-edge work of the Watershed Research Cooperative, an interdisciplinary collaboration of private and public entities with a mission to quantify the effects of contemporary forest practices on forest streams. So what did they tell us? Well, the Ankle Creek study showed us that with modern stream buffers, stream temperature increases following harvest are very small, and they don't actually accumulate in a downstream direction even when we harvest a relatively large percentage of the watershed. Those changes were all within range of natural variability. The LC study showed us that forest harvest resulted in modest increases in stream flows during the transition months, and that there are no major increases in sediment delivery, and following harvest, cutthroat trout biomass and abundance actually increase. There's a lot more, but understanding the time is short, the recorded testimony and the meeting materials for that hearing, they're all on OLIS, and they're also linked in my written testimony. Please, if you have time, watch that hearing. And bearing in mind the millions of dollars of research that presentation represents, ask yourself, does that science comport with the recitals in this bill? But what about the CESARA disapproval? Didn't NOAA and EPA disapprove Oregon's coastal program on the basis of deficient forest practices? They did, but that's not the whole story. The modest grant monies available under the Coastal Zone Act reauthorization amendments, that is CESARA, are contingent on a state's voluntary participation in a program administered by a small group inside NOAA. We strongly believe that the federal finding was an error. More than that, we think it was illegal. The agencies failed to produce any science actually connecting contemporary forest practices in Oregon with water quality standard exceedances. Instead, they cited esoteric literature like unpublished DEQ outlines and European Union stream flow analyses, and made sweeping assertions that Oregon hasn't done enough and that the agencies still have concerns. The sad part for me as OFIC's attorney is that because CESARA is a voluntary program, private parties like OFIC don't have the standing to challenge that decision. We've asked the state to stand up for itself in court, but so far, at least, this governor's refused. The best we can do is point you to the state's own submission as evidence of Oregon's program being fully approvable. I've attached excerpts to my testimony. The complete testimony is actually available by link in my written comments. In that document, you will find under signature of DEQ and DLCD, right there, a robust defense of Oregon's Forest Practices Act and our unique land use system. In the end, this is a picture of a clear cut. It's not as pretty as a lush green forest, and the proponents of this bill would like you to think that all our lands look this way all the time. But in fact, that ground only looks that way for a short while, and then again, not again for several decades. This is what a clear cut looks like at 2 years, and 4 years, and this is what it looks like at 50 years. And at least on the west side of Oregon, at that age, we can begin harvesting the fastest growing trees to make the homes we live in and the products we all use. And this cycle is happening all across our private forests, with some portion of our forest perpetually in older age classes and some portion newly harvested. And as highlighted by the science I just described to you, we do all of that while simultaneously providing excellent habitat for wildlife and fish and the cleanest water in Oregon. So with that, let's turn to the second argument. If you listen to these guys, you'd think the Oregon timber industry was dying on the vine, and we should forego timber harvest, place it with tourism and backpacking. Well, they're right about one thing. The Oregon timber industry is smaller than it used to be. Some will tell you that it's because of automation and union busting. You'd be wrong about that, too. This slide shows you historic harvest volumes in Oregon from 1962 through 2010. The red represents trees coming off public land, and the blue represents private land. This part right here, in about 1990, is a sharp decline in federal timber production that few people could forget. I lived through that as a high schooler in Wallowa County. The federal injunctions literally dismantled my community. And at least in one way, I helped. I was on a welding and cutting crew that tore down the Boise Cascade Mill. On the day we blew up the foundations, a crowd gathered. Some people cried. This slide shows you mill closures. The yellow dots are mills in operation as of 2010. The black dots are the mills that have closed since 1980. This up here in the corner, that's Wild County right up there. You'll note that all three mills in my county were shuttered. And it's a long road out of there. That's not automation. That's gutting an industry. Shortly after the mill closures, I remember seeing giant man with grease-stained hands bagging my groceries at Safeway. Today, private timberlands comprise only 34% of Oregon's forest lands, yet they produce 75% of the annual harvest. Federal timberlands comprise 60% of Oregon's forest lands, yet they produce only 15% of the harvest volume. As a state, we're still feeling the effects of the shutdown of the federal forests. As you know, many rural counties in Oregon are in crisis, discontinuing basic public services due to a lack of funding. While recreation is an important part of Oregon's economy, including robust recreation opportunities on private lands, there's little hope that it will close the gap. If it could, it would have already. But let's go back to the historic harvest graph. In the blue area, that's private land timber production. You'll notice that output from private lands have been relatively stable for more than 40 years, right around 3 billion board feet. What does this represent? Some will tell you it's nothing more than profits feeding big corporations, but they're wrong again. As I mentioned, more than 60,000 Oregonians are employed by the timber industry, with an annual payroll of over $3 billion. While forest sector jobs comprise a small percentage of the total employment in Multnomah County, in Douglas County, the industry comprises 13% of the total employment, 9% in Coos County, and 7% in Linn County, to name but a few. Notably, all of those are counties with large private timberland holdings. And what does this industry produce? We literally use sunlight to take carbon out of the air and turn it into renewable and sustainable building products. If I may, I'll say that again. We literally use sunlight to take carbon out of the air and turn it into renewable and sustainable building products. That's the magic of forestry. And those building products produce some of the most beautiful structures in our state. Recent developments in wood product manufacturing allow us to build taller structures than ever before. And they're in growing demand. In fact, you might find it ironic that this very week, more than 800 building designers, developers, and architects from around the globe have flown to Portland, Oregon to attend the International Mass Timber Conference because there's unbridled excitement in that sector about using carbon-neutral, renewable building materials to create tall buildings, and our state, Oregon, is a national leader in this innovation. There are extraordinary opportunities ahead, and there's an overwhelming majority who have moved past the tired, debunked assertions in this bill and are instead focused on our future and how wood will be a part of the solution. But it's easy to forget that these products require that we harvest trees. It's even easier to forget that jobs mean humans. Who are these people that manage trees, and what do they do? Well, here's some of them. This is a small collection of photos sent to us by our membership. These are all real people doing work in the woods. These are foresters, engineers, hydrologists, factory workers. This is, increasingly, a science-driven, innovative industry. And for young people, there's abundant professional opportunity. Look, the timber industry in Oregon is a lot more than a logo on a soccer jersey worn by a hipster downtown. It's a vibrant and important part of Oregon's economy. Whether it stays that way is up to you. The people in this room are proud of the work we do. We stand before you with a clear conscience. In defiance of the statements made by the proponents of this bill, please, for the love of Oregon, vote no on House Bill 3226. Thank you.
Okay, Susan, you got about 5 minutes.
Thank you. You can hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. Chair Clem, Vice Chairs McLean and Springer, and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to address you today. My name is Susan Watkins. My husband and I own a very small forest outside McMinnville. As a master woodland manager, I helped plan and write the Ties to the Land succession planning program that's been used around the country to help resource landowners plan for generational transfer of their lands. I served for more than 6 years on the Committee for Family Forest Lands, which is a board appointed by the Board of Forestry to advise it about interests of small landowners. In my final year on that committee, I was the acting chair. I am familiar with issues that are of concern to Oregon's 44,000 small woodland owners. And as a representative of these landowners and also as a forest owner myself, this bill concerns me greatly. I've submitted written testimony, so here this morning I'll just emphasize 2 points. First, land use. Earlier this week, I emailed you this map, which shows forest ownership in Oregon. Small woodlands are in red, and you'll see that they ring the deeper forests that are publicly and industrially owned, and they also ring the developed and urban areas. The data sheet I submitted with my maps tells the story of Oregon forests today, and as you can see, a telling statistic is that since 1953, we have maintained the same acreage in forests. It's still 30 million acres as it was back then. I would submit to you that the persistence of our forest land is in very large part due both to Oregon's visionary land use laws and to the commitment of small forest owners to their lands. Neighboring states cannot make the same claims. Washington State has lost 700,000 acres of timberland between 1978 and 2001. And California also sees conversion of small forests as a major issue today. Yet it's small forests that provide many of the benefits that we've heard talked about today, being those lands that are at the bottom of the hill, if you will. The water that comes into our communities for drinking water or for irrigation on farms flows through our forests. The large animals in Oregon come down to our forests in winter to browse when it's too icy and snowy up above. These woods, it's our woods, our small woods, that most of us see from our towns and from roads as we're driving around the state. And our woods, through various programs and partnerships, are often available for educational opportunities and for a lot of recreation that's close to home. But this bill will put tremendous economic pressure on these small forests. Small forest landowners take income from their forests, usually through a commercial thinning of their lands or for maybe a once-in-a-lifetime serious harvest. My husband and I, for example, planted our forests in 1994. We're not going to live long enough to harvest those trees. What we planted was a beautiful place to live. Lots of wildlife, birds, plants, and what we hope we planted was an economic asset to our children. But I'm afraid that legislation like this bill will turn that asset into an economic burden. Children who watch their parents struggle with onerous and costly regulation as they try to eke some economic benefit from their land are very likely to decide that that effort isn't worth it, and they will sell when they inherit the property. And selling at these locations of these properties is going to be more likely to a development company than to a forestry company. Pressure to extend urban growth boundaries or rezone these lands, which at that time will be considered unproductive and marginal because they're not being maintained, that pressure will grow and that ring of red in the map will fade. Second point I'd like to address.
Just about 1 minute.
1 minute.
You're already
okay.
At 15.
I just wanted to address the Forest Practices Act. You already have this sheet, I see, before you, and I submitted another sheet of additions to the Forest Practices Act over the years. And I just want to emphasize that citizen groups like the CFF and the Forest Practices Committees, of which there are three around the state, review all of these changes. There's plenty of opportunity for public input on them. And we also had the opportunity to bring up new ideas that the department and Board of Forestry perhaps hadn't considered, like seedling availability, for example, and try to encourage new rules around those issues. So in my tenure on the CFF, I saw many changes, including the rip stream change, the forest buffers that was mentioned earlier here. These changes take a long time. They have to be based in science. The numeric criteria that this bill would require, we can't just borrow it from another state with different soils and species. We have to do the science here ourselves. It'll be decades before any of those criteria can be established, and in the meantime, uncertainty will lead a lot of people to either harvest now as much as they can or sell. So thank you for listening.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Okay, I'd like to ask Mary Skurlock, Nancy Webster, and David Diesler or Deisler. You three are going to have about 3 minutes each or 9 minutes total. We have 60 more people after this and 50 minutes. So it's a little bit awkward. I'm going to try not have people just have like 10 seconds each. But if you could stick to 9 minutes, I would really appreciate it.
So what is the order?
I've got Mary first, but...
Thank you, Chair Clem. I'll try to be brief. My name is Mary Skurlock, and I've been asked to testify today because of my professional experience seeking policy change in Oregon to protect freshwater ecosystems from harmful forest practices on non-federal lands. I'm a former land use attorney, which I gave up quickly, and longtime policy director at Pacific Rivers Council, where I evaluated forest practices rules across the West and the nation and coordinated expert science input on numerous multi-species aquatic habitat conservation plans under the ESA in Oregon, Washington, California, Idaho, and Montana. I'm currently an independent freshwater policy consultant for conservation coalitions in Oregon and Washington, both of which deal exclusively with forest practices as they affect aquatic ecosystems on private lands. I hold degrees from Duke and Boston University School of Law, but I'm here today representing only myself. I've worked closely with and built great respect for the members of the timber community, whom you've heard from today. But nonetheless, I am here today to make 3 points. One, that freshwater ecosystems are being degraded by non-federal logging practices, and that this body should engage in thoughtful review of the science that I think will bear this out. No single study tells the whole story. Secondly, existing administrative mechanisms for adaptive policy change are incapable, demonstrably, of addressing the problem effectively. The delta between our rules and others in the region are illustrative of this fact, and the changes needed are simply too great to address piecemeal without taking decades to achieve. In conclusion, legislative attention to solving these problems is sorely needed. This is not a yes or no answer on a single bill. This is a conversation that I think deserves thoughtful attention to what is needed to protect public natural resources owned by all Oregonians. So I commend to you, I have provided some written testimony. I would like to just speak specifically to the example of the rulemaking that recently occurred that has taken almost 20 years to address a single water quality criterion, the sole objective of the rule, but only applies to a fraction of the streams in the state of Oregon, and has not achieved, according to the department's own analysis, the objective of the rule. Your assistance and oversight of these issues is sorely needed. Thank you.
Ahead of schedule. Thank you. Sorry, Nancy?
Hi, my name is Nancy Webster. I reside in Rockaway Beach, Oregon, and I grew up on the central southern Oregon coast, Coos County. My father was a lumber grader at Weyerhaeuser before at Pope and Talbot. My grandfather and uncles worked in logging, agriculture, and mills. I'm here to talk about Jetty Creek. I drink the water at Jetty Creek. That is the sole source of water for Rockaway Beach. And it, as the slide shows, it's also listed as threatened coho, trout, and steelhead habitat. And you can see how this whole, on this map, there's all these feeder streams that feed into the main line. The only area really protected with buffers at all is the purple line, which is actually fish habitat. This is really steep. The fish can't go beyond that barrier. I want to talk that since I first visited Jetty Creek, these are my personal observations and observations of friends, and also I represent over 200 citizens with the Rockaway Beach Citizens for Watershed Protection who are concerned about the current forest practice as an aerial spraying affecting their watershed and neighboring communities. There's a slide of Jetty Creek. In 2012, I hiked into this watershed with my friend, retired water quality tester. We were overwhelmed by what we saw. We saw lower wetlands logged. We saw no buffers on feeder streams, tributaries that feed into Jetty Creek. We talked with two contract loggers that were working, educated young men. They were concerned about this type of logging in a watershed, and then they said they'll aerial spray. You need to call ODF and get involved. This is your drinking water. So between 2004 and 2013, 82% of this watershed was logged, and as you can see, it's pretty devastated. And in the meantime, I've hiked into that watershed with experts in forestry, fish and wildlife, and here is some of their comments I will read. This is following observations. One, this is an inappropriately high percentage of logging for a drinking water source. Two, logging done across tributaries, streams that feed into Jetty Creek leave no buffers. Because of this clear-cutting and lack of adequate natural buffers to stop sediment from entering the creek, there is a higher risk for excessive water turbidity. Steep slopes adjacent to this creek that have minimal buffers are already showing evidence of large earth movement and slope failure. This is slide area, you know, refer to the Slido maps of Oregon. In 2015, after some storms, there were six major slides directly above our treatment plant on Jetty Creek, wiping out part of the treatment plant. I have often hiked up in there and observed muddy waters after rains. This is an indication of high turbidity. I talked to the treatment plant operator in Rockaway. He said that at times he's had to stay up all night waiting for cleaner water to make clean water. And when you add, it becomes necessary to add more chlorine when you have higher turbidity that results in high levels of trihalomethanes. Rockaway Beach between 2004 and 2013 had more trihalomethane violations than anywhere else in the state. Trihalomethanes are a carcinogen. The Rockaway Beach has then put in a new treatment plant on pressure of violating EPA rules. That treatment plant didn't work. That was $1.5 million. It required another upgrade. There was no help from the timber industries on putting in this plant. I think our community is also very concerned about the aerial spraying. It's a cocktail of chemicals going into our watershed. When they spray, I can smell it. Other people smell it. There's reports of neighbors feeling woozy, nauseated, sick on days of spraying. So, I am really tired of hearing from agency administrators, forest managers, owners of companies that cost-benefit analysis is how we determine how a forest is managed. But I do not hear people talking about the factors of water quality, public health, fish habitat in that discussion. Maybe fish, but not drinking water.
And you've taken all but 1 minute of his time, so
oh,
you
no.
could wrap up.
Okay, in summary, I think we really need to change these practices so this doesn't happen in other watersheds or, again, in our watershed. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Please.
My 30 seconds.
Yeah, we'll give a little latitude. You two can argue about that later. So a minute and a half would be great.
Okay. Chairman Clem and vice chairs and members of the committee, my name is David Eisler. I live in Walton, Oregon, Lane County. I own and manage 160 acres of forest land in the Coast Range. Our timber stands have been FSC certified over the last 20 years. On average, we thin areas of the stands every 5 years. Our management goals are for long-term biodiversity and forest health while harvesting sustainable volumes of hardwoods and softwoods. I reluctantly send some of my logs to local mills because we can never compete with the timber industry with mill prices that reflect large volumes of logs coming off thousands of acres of clear cuts. Sustainable long-term thinning and individual tree selection requires smaller equipment, more manual labor, making our cost per log higher. Some of us non-industrial forest landowners run small portable sawmills to produce specialty lumber for building, cabinetry, furniture, and flooring. I'm not going to be able to get through. You have my testimony. I wanted to speak to the opportunities for the legislature to incentivize the costs of managing truly sustainable forest stands. My main concern is with industrial plantation stands, clear cutting. There's a very high cost to society in general. All Oregonians are paying a price for some of the impacts of industrial forest management, short-term rotation. I believe there are ways to incentivize good production, good management on the smaller stands and maybe even the industrial stands. The benefits of truly sustainable forest management seem self-evident. How can legislators move private forestry in that direction, provide incentives, reduce or eliminate the tax on harvested timber for long-term sustainable harvests? Increase the tax on high-impact extractive forestry to provide assistance payments for sustainable forestry. Develop a carbon market which pays forest landowners to leave tracts uncut for varying periods of time. Shift the millions of dollars that have gone to the Oregon Forest Research Institute that has been used for educational programs and informational brochures that are essentially PR for the industrial forest model. And shift those funds to programs and information that educate the public in models for management of healthy forests. The state of Oregon should invest in forest management that benefits all Oregonians by providing incentives for responsible long-term forest management rather than supporting industrial management that yields high profits and sometimes is for global investors while creating costs for the people of Oregon. As we enter the unavoidable period of climate change, the vast acreage of industrial plantations will not fare well. Legislators need to consider and anticipate the consequences for our state's economy and its natural resources. I urge you to consider House Bill 3226. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Okay, so just for those folks, you're excused. For those folks watching, I had told both sides, give us a good 15 minutes on each side, then a good 9 minutes on each side. The opponent said we can give up our 9 minutes, but because I wanted to have ODF come up. After ODF, we're going to go into public testimony. I will say this right off the bat, just so there's, you know, people don't feel treated unfairly. There are 48 people here against. There are only 14 for. So I will just pause it right now. There are more here against than are for. But if you're against and you're willing to just not talk and give a thumbs down when I call your name, you'll help have more people talk. If you want to talk, that's fine. But everyone's only going to have 1 minute. And if you can just give a thumbs down, it may look like you're not getting fair time because I know there's a lot of you here against it. But we'll say right now there are 48 against, 14 for. And so in the body crowd, you won. But if you could save time with a thumbs down instead of talking, that would be awesome.
Mr. Chair, yeah. Can I ask a question?
And in the meantime, let me get the people walking for efficiency. ODF, can you go ahead and come on up? And yes.
So when they indicate thumbs down, I assume that's going to be registered on the record by you or
somebody? We already have on the record your names and that you're against it. It's just when I call you up, if you feel like someone else already said your topic and you give a thumbs down, we'll have you written. I will say there's a thumbs down, but you will let someone else chat. If you don't feel that what you have to say has been said yet, come on up and say it in 1 minute. Okay.
Good morning, Clem and members, Chair Clem and members of the committee. I am Peter Doherty, and I serve as Oregon State Forester and Director of the Department of Forestry. Our department has no position on House Bill 3226. However, I always appreciate the opportunity to talk about Oregon's Forest Practice Act, or FPA as we refer to it. Oregon's Forest Practice Act is a cornerstone to Oregon's policy and regulatory framework for protecting resources on non-federal lands. Now, we often talk about it as a separate entity, but it fits within a framework, and that relies on two strong regulatory components, and then it's augmented by a voluntary components. Oregon's strong land use laws that maintain forest land and forest use provide resource protection by avoiding the negative impacts to resources from development. So that's the first tier, keeping working forest working. The Forest Practice Act works in concert with the land use laws to ensure economically efficient forest practices that ensure the continuous growing and harvesting of forest tree species and the maintenance of forest land for such purpose as a leading use on private lands. So it's designed to maintain working forests. The rules also ensure sound management of soil, air, water, fish, and wildlife resources. Finally, the third tier is the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watershed, provides for additional voluntary approaches to improve water quality and resource outcomes on forest land. This three-tiered approach results in forest land having the highest water quality in the state of Oregon. The FPA assures Oregonians that private forest lands are managed with resource protections and that a stable regulatory environment exists for forest businesses. It was enacted in 1971. It's been modified over 30 times since its inception. It requires reforestation and scientifically supported best management practices for all aspects of forestry, including stream protection, water quality, road construction, pesticide application, sensitive wildlife sites, and other resources. When evaluating the effectiveness of our overall framework, we focus on outcomes rather than management measures, such as actual water quality as an outcome. The department supports the Board of Forestry in adopting policy, rules, and best management practices to achieve these outcomes. The board values and conducts an open and transparent public process with members of the public, stakeholders, and other natural resource agencies. We support the board's adaptive management process by conducting effectiveness and compliance monitoring to ensure that the FPA and associated rules are being implemented and those rules are meeting the desired outcomes of resource protections. I'd be pleased to provide more information and answer any questions you may have on this overall framework for protecting resources, the strong land use, the Forest Practice Act, and voluntary measures. So thank you.
Oh, you just got us 6 minutes back. That is fantastic. Okay.
In that vein.
Yeah. Vice Chair Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Peter, one of the things that comes up in the flavor of the conversation we're having in this room and outside this room is we have less forested land than we did a few years ago, and that there's just mass destruction of forested land. Can you talk to us a little bit? Do you have some numbers and some data to speak to that?
Yeah, and so you've heard about the sustainable harvest over the past 40 years. So private forest land have provided about 3 billion board feet on average for 40 years. So that's one indication. You can't keep harvesting if you're not continuously growing those trees to harvest. But we have been tracking land use since 1974, and 98% of wildland forests that existed in 1974 are still in wildland forests. By wildland forests, we mean below a low housing density, so below 4 houses per square mile. On industrial land, there's been virtually no change on public and industrial lands. We have had some loss on, as alluded by the family forest land member, we have had loss in the family forest land. About 6% of that has been lost since 1974, 8% in western Oregon. We're also compared to Washington, and in contrast, Washington's lost, I think, 23% of their family forest lands on the west side compared to 8% of ours. So when we talk about the complete system, people will say Washington has stronger buffers than we have. And as you get wider with buffers, the marginal return on resource protection decreases, but the cost goes up widely. And so it's easy to have much more costly regulations if you have the ability just to convert it to non-forest use. And for example, there in the Puget Sound area in Washington, 25% of their working forests were converted between 1988 and 2004. And that's having a significant impact on the water quality in the Puget Sound. So when you want to look at outcomes, you want to look at both of those together.
Let me see if anybody else. Okay, yep, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that, Peter. So one of the things that we've heard a fair amount about is aerial spraying of pesticides and the concern with that. And it sounds almost sometimes like it's pretty haphazard. So talk to us about the Forest Practices Act, how it regulates pesticide use, how it's monitored, and a little bit of the studies, if there's studies in fact and science that goes into this equation.
So again, if you want to look at pesticide regulation, you need to look at the overall framework, which starts with Environmental Protection Agency and FIFRA, which I won't remember. It's the Federal Insecticide, Rodenticide, and something else act. But they regulate and have label requirements for all pesticides and approve pesticide use for various things. In forestry, we primarily use herbicides, which is a subset of pesticides. So that's the first layer of regulation. Secondly, there's Oregon's pesticide use laws, which are regulated by Oregon Department of Agriculture. The FPA provides additional restrictions around riparian areas to protect resources. And most recently, because of this legislative body, we now administer buffers around homes and schools, which was passed by the legislature. We did, as soon as we passed our new buffers for pesticide applications on aerial, we did do monitoring of in 2000, and we did not find any detections of pesticides in water that were above one part per billion. We're not the only ones that are monitoring. We collaborate with ODA and Department of Environmental Quality on the pesticide stewardship partner. There's been one forestry area that's been in that monitoring study, and while we find detections in water, they're always consistently below the any standards set by the Water Quality Pesticide Management Team. And finally, one additional study, the United States Geological Survey and the East Eugene Water and Electric Board conducted a 10-year study of the McKinsey watershed. And I'll just cut to the chase. In contrast with urban runoff, where they did find pesticides. Compounds associated with commercial forestry pesticide use were rarely detected in the McKenzie River, even though forest land accounts for the majority of the property in the basin. And EWEB is now focused on their rural residential part of their watershed to increase protections there.
Thank you.
Okay. We've got a minute and a half left of your savings, so I'm going to excuse you. I'm going to go back to my now list, and 1 minute each, and I will be severely strict about the 1 minute now because we're not going to get through everybody, but even at 1 minute, we're going to lose half the people. So, Judy Coleman, you came from over 100 miles away. We always invite people who came that far up first, so please come up, Judy Coleman. Tom Bender, we've got you on the phone, and I know you've got a health challenge, so that's why you're on the phone, and Pam Birmingham. So, Judy, if you're, are you Pam?
Yeah.
And Judy, please. And I'm going to say who's on deck, because that'll help us also be prepared to come up. Michael Newton, Ron Gilson, Karen Gilson. If any of you are thumbs down people, then Dan O'Brien, Neil Schroeder, and Annabelle would be after. Annabelle Morgan would be after them. Okay. 1 minute.
I wasn't really prepared to testify, but I would like to say that I invite anyone to come to Rockaway Beach and hike the Jetty Creek watershed with me and see what the Forest Practices Act, as written, allows.
And remind us of your name.
My name's Judy Coleman.
Okay, thank you, Judy.
Yeah. I see this as an out-of-balance system, and I would like to separate the large timber industry from the smaller woodlot owners in some of these conversations on sustainable logging. And I really appreciate Greg's, or this man's, statement about incentivization. Where needed to create more jobs in the state. I think Oregon needs to step up to the plate and preserve its its jobs and its natural resources.
Great, and thank you for coming so far. And you're Pam? Welcome.
I'm Pam Birmingham. Thank you for taking the time to hear all of us. I live in the Astoria District in rural Clatsop County. I'm a small woodlot owner. I have a degree in forestry, worked as a park ranger, and for the past 25 years have been a real estate broker in rural Clatsop County. Back in 1999, there was a land exchange planned that converted ODF land into public land. It was contested by many people, and because of that, the parcels in question were very widely studied. So we had independent biological assessments, habitat surveys, all sorts of things done. So ODF had this book, huge book, of knowledge about these parcels, that there was landslide escarpment, very susceptible to sliding, could damage core coho habitat.
About 30 seconds left.
So the trade went through. The trees have hit the ground. I live next door to one of the parcels. I have seen mud flows. I have seen debris flows into Humbug Creek, which was a pristine watershed. My domestic water system has silted in from this. I live for the last 9 months with not a drop of running water in my house. And this private timber company has walked away with several million dollars in timber, and yet I have no drinking water until I can get enough money to put in a well.
We're at our limit here. We've got 60 other people. So
okay.
Everyone else, I'm serious, 1 minute. Tom, sorry, that includes you. So please get us started. Tom Bender.
Hi, for the record, I'm Tom Bender, a 40-year resident on the Yukon Mountains on the Oregon coast. I moved to Oregon in 74 at the request of Governor Tom McCall's office to do energy research. I coined the term sustainability in 1975 and have been the developer of sustainable economics since then. Looking at today just a single element of Oregon forestry, the graph on page one on my written testimony is an MAI curve, which is showing that short rotations produce only a very small fraction of the yearly timber production of long rotations. The reason is stumps don't produce timber, and it takes 20 years to even capture the full sunlight that runs the whole show. A 240-year rotation produces 20 to 30 times more total economic return. It produces three or more times the net timber per year. And comparing the cost savings and other elements, impacts on other forestry uses, long rotations give much greater benefit. My recommendation regarding House Bill 3226 is to amend it and simply mandate that all private and public timberland covered by the Forest Practices Act immediately change to 240-year rotations. My written testimony gives details on portions of that.
Okay, thank you, Tom.
Testimony at the Board of Forestry meeting in November, they failed to even include that in their minutes. It took me 4 months to get them to do that.
Okay, Tom, yes, we've noted your proposal. Thank you. And I would like to ask Michael Newton, Ron Gilson, and Karen Gilson to come up, unless you're a thumbs down people.
240-year average.
Maybe one of you is a thumbs down and sending the other, the better half or the lower half, however you two in your marriage sort that out. Okay, Dan O'Brien, could you join us then? Okay, 1 minute, gentlemen. Okay, Neil Schroeder.
Thumbs down.
Oh, boy. Annabelle Morgan. Come on and join us, please. Okay. 1 minute, gentlemen.
I'm Michael Newton. I'm a professor emeritus of forest ecology at Oregon State University. I've been working on herbicides and their influence on wildlife habitat and reforestation. I want to make very clear, when you're talking about pesticides, you have to divide those between herbicides, which affect herbs, plant poisons, versus insecticides, which is an entirely different class of material. So when you say pesticides, you make an inaccurate statement about either one, because what it does is it sends the wrong message. Want to say something about the situation in my 40 years of herbicide studies. Herbicides influence only vegetation. The name or the chemical involved in an herbicide product will only influence certain kinds of vegetation. They're all selective. We pick the herbicide to go after specific targets or groups of targets.
And I'm sorry, but your time is up.
Okay.
But yeah, please. No, there's lots of people who want yours, so if you don't want to talk. So go ahead.
Ron Gelson, and I'm from Benton County at the present time. I used to live in Lane County, and I was Lane County president of Small Woodland Association. I speak to you as a small woodland owner for almost 40 years now, and I feel that this house bill will be detrimental to small woodland owners. It's a big net. We'll all get trapped in all these rules and regulations. You have a very difficult job. You almost look like two different Oregons here. The pictures you see and what my land looks like, I have a tree farm. It is a forest. I don't recognize the pictures that I see, and I encourage you to certainly go out and look. It's just not the way that small woodlands forest have.
So. You're Dan O'Brien?
Okay.
Is that right?
No.
Okay. Ron Gilson.
Oh, thank you, Ron. Okay.
Yeah. So I'm interested in ground truth. Jetty Creek, I'm sympathetic to what's happened to them. Who can look at those pictures and not be concerned for them? But tree farms are forests, and please don't impede my efforts to be able to manage my forest and harvest when I need to, because the trees don't live forever on my lands. They top out and stop growing, and they need to be harvested. Thank you.
Thank you, Ron. And thank your wife for giving up her time. And please, Annabelle.
I
Thank you so much for allowing us to testify today. And like you said, you've got a very difficult task. I know that this is sort of coming up along on the California bill. And I have an uncle who's 100 years old, has been in the forestry industry most of his life, and lives down in Willow Creek, California. And he has seen devastation of the industry and of California's income and the people and the forests. I also have a friend living along the Klamath River. This summer, there was a huge fire in that area. It took out some of the people along their farmland, and they had cattle ranging up through the hills. They have lost about 30 of their calves this year. They've lost steers. They've lost all this because the forests were not managed well, like the small woodland people do. And then this creates the loss of the forest by fire. And that also creates a very detrimental impact upon the watershed and the rivers and our environment. I also would like you to think about the legacy.
And actually, that's it. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay. Back to the other side. Candace Bonner, Wendy Cien, and Joan Zuber. Candace Bonner, Wendy, T-S-I-E-N, and Joan Zuber. Okay, let's try. If you're making your way here, that's fine. We'll try Tom Wolf. Did Mary Adamson already testify?
We're in the other room.
Oh, I know. I'm so sorry. Okay, and just tell us your names as you start. And
I'm Candace Bonner.
Thank you, Candace.
I live on 109 forested acres bordered by BLM, industrial timberland, and other small woodland owners, and I'm speaking for myself and my neighbors. I've had the opportunity to watch day in and day out, season to season, year to year, in all weathers, what happens to our streams with harvest by industrial timber companies, small woodland owners, and federal foresters, and the great difference in results. Because of this, I have long been convinced that our forest practices rules need to be rewritten, especially in terms of better riparian protection. Our recent proposed riparian rules changes fall far short of what the best available science tells us we need. There's always a fine line to walk between protecting resources needed by all Oregonians and the rights of private land ownership. Oregon has shown by its land use laws that it understands there is a need to protect some public values on private land. As we move into climate change, water will be above and beyond our most valuable and essential resource. I am not sure this bill is the right way to reform the Forest Practices Act, but I strongly support reform now, as irreversible changes in our forested lands and the waters of the state are progressing every day. I invite all committee members who would like an on-the-ground look at real streams and real forests harvested in different ways to come spend a morning walking through the woods with me. Thank you.
Thank you, Candace. And Wendy?
Yes, my name is Joan Zuber. I live in Clackamas County on small woodland property. I think that this bill is heading in the right direction, but I believe it needs some work. I think it is probably a little bit more to it than what there needs to be to accomplish a protection for streams, and I would really encourage offering more protection for streams. I really have a lot of respect for some of the industrial landowners that are around me, but then I've seen some areas like on the upper Molalla River where there have been thousands of acres that are cut, and this is a stream that has problems with temperature. In 2015, there was a salmon kill because the salmon were coming up the river. The river was at 74 degrees. They went for the first stream that they could turn off that had cool water, got blocked. They couldn't go that far, and they died. And I think that probably some of the effects of having high temperatures and the lack of timber in the upper reaches, snow goes off faster. Temperatures are warmer.
And Wendy?
Hello, good morning. My name is Wendy Chen. I live just outside Eugene. Listening to all the people who have spoken thus far, I feel that we, all of us, care deeply about the forest lands in Oregon. We care deeply about the quality of our watersheds, our waterways, our fish populations, our human populations. And I just know that we have, all of us, no matter which way we may think we mostly lean, we need to join together and really pay attention to where we are right this moment and where we know that we are headed with increasing impacts from climate change. So I would definitely at this point support HB 3226, but I do feel that certainly everyone is going to want to make some changes, but we must all come together.
Thank you three so much. Okay. Now I've got Henry Walheis, Keith Richmond, Stephen Cafferata. A thumbs down. Thank you. And what's your name, sir? Both of you too? Okay. Then how about Walda Cotter something?
Wilda.
And are you going to come testify? Okay, please come on up. Dale Clausen, Bruce Alber. If you're here, please come on up. Okay, we'll wait for Bruce. Did we get Dale?
Dale's in the other room.
Okay, Dale, your thumbs down. David Rankin. Bruce, or sir, are you our...
I'm a thumbs down.
Okay, and what was your name?
Keith.
And Albert.
And Bruce, no need to talk. Nope, you're just a thumbs down. David Rankin. Jim Letourneau. It might be in the other room. Wilda, why don't you tell us in a minute what you have to tell us, and we'll see who else shows up from the other room.
Okay. All right, I'm Wilda Cafferetta. I'm a small woodland owner. With my husband, I manage about 300 acres. You've heard a lot about this, so I'll just sort of abbreviate. One of my concerns is the whereas parts of this bill. I think that some of the statements in there are clearly opinion, not fact. And I think some of them are blatantly, from my perspective, some of them are blatantly untrue. So I would ask all of the committee to look at those whereas statements with a very critical eye. That's one point I want to make. Second point I want to make is the part of the bill that says that local governments, county governments, can make also changes beyond that what the state makes to this, to forest practices. Because we own land in three counties, so that we'd be trying to manage our land under three different regulations. Four, it'd just be very difficult to manage our land under those circumstances.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Sir? And your name?
Chairman Clem. I'm David Rankin. I live in Western Lane County. I happen to live on 184 acres of small woodlands. I'm going to make my, unaccustomed as I am to testifying, I'll make it real quick here. I have submitted written testimony to the committee, and I appreciate your time and effort in giving us a chance to talk. My feeling for this bill, House Bill 3226, is thumbs down. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for making the trek from the other room. Tell us your name and what you'd like to say.
Yes, my name is Jim Letourneau, and my wife and I manage timberland in Yamhill County, home of the famous Pinot Noir grapes at this point in time.
Yeah.
And we've been doing this a long time. We've been in the business over 50 years. With regard to this House bill, I'm concerned about it affecting us economically. We do this full time. I planted a forestation about 100 acres that were formerly in prune orchards, and that is high site value Pinot Noir grapes sites, and we're now timber. But if this impacts my family economically, we will more than likely look for other means of income off of that property. So thank you.
Okay, thanks, Jim. Okay, back to the other side. I've got Tom Wolf and Reed Wilson, Benton County, maybe coming from the other room. Tom, why don't you get us started while we see if Reed is available?
Chair Clem, committee members, for record, my name is Tom Wolf with Trout Unlimited. I would like to, the science has already been covered. I want to make this very personal and very quick because you already have my testimony on O-List. I'm here today because my grandfather, who was a logger for 53 years, charged me right before he died with fixing the mess, and he used swear words in that statement, that his generation left. And Trout Unlimited supports the concept of HB 3226, and let's face it, it's not going anywhere, but it asks some great questions. What are we doing on non-fish-bearing streams? What are we doing on things? Things that need to be asked, hopefully things that will be done in the Board of Forestry, but I think it's questions that you should be asking Board of Forestry. So, and Trout Unlimited and myself are not opposed to the logging industry. I grew up with a father to log till 12 during the summers, and it helped sustain our family economy. We need logging in Oregon. It's part of providing rural jobs, but we need to answer the questions of HB 3226, and I urge you to do so. Thank you.
Thank you. And Reed.
My name is Reed Wilson. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Benton Forest Coalition. We represent about 200 people in and around Corvallis. I'm a businessman from Corvallis. And first, I want to reiterate my appreciation for the small woodlot owners, many of whom are my neighbors, who sustainably manage their forests. Okay. But I want to speak to the future of Oregon's economy. According to the Oregon Tourism Commission, tourism in Oregon is a $10.7 billion industry, directly generates 105,000 jobs, and indirectly supports an additional 74,000 jobs. Also, there was a landmark study published by the Sonoran Institute. They analyzed economies throughout the West and found that economies based on resource extraction were stagnant, while economies based on recreation, service, high tech, and retirement income were growing and thriving. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Reed. Okay. So that's my list of the four. Everyone else here is against. So if you want a thumbs down, fine. If you'd like to come up, we have 8 minutes left, and there's three pages of you. So Adam Stinnett, Carl Harrison, William Wincoop.
Thumbs down.
Okay. And you are?
Adam Stinnett.
Thanks. Okay. So then Monica.
Thumbs down.
Oh, boy, this is going well so far. Steve Weber.
No.
Okay. Van something?
Decker.
Excuse yep.
Chairman, Carl Harrison. You just skipped over me.
Yeah, yeah. I come on.
I yield my time to Mike Newton.
Okay. I think you already talked once. Can't do that. I'm so sorry. It's against our rules here. Terry Lamers. But Carl, you're welcome to come up. Okay, thumbs down. And there's some great Greg Peterson, you're here. Nancy Hathaway, please join us. Okay, 1 minute each. Welcome.
Well, hi, I'm Bill Winecoop. I've been a forester for 44 years, and most of that time I've worked in the Coast Range along its rivers and streams. Some of my work is in stream restoration projects where we remove old culverts and improve fish passage and put structures in streams. And part of my work is also establishing buffers in logging units to protect the streams as we log over them. This is part of the process of harvest and renewal, which I take great pride in. I see the results. We got miles of unobstructed fish passage, beds of spawning gravel where none existed before, shaded streams, and to my delight, thousands of baby coho darting back and forth. If this bill passes, these efforts by private industry will come to a halt.
Thank you, sir.
Yes, my name is Terry Lammers. I'm a Polk County forest landowner. And, yeah, I'm strongly against this bill, Mr. Chair and committee. Basically, to me, it looks like the presumptions in the bill, they base everything on the premise, the assumption that clear-cutting is harmful, and then run with that. And landslides are a natural event. My brother and I, we have a logging company. We've salvaged log two landslides. And if you know how to see landslides, you can see them in the hills of South Salem and in many other areas of the Coast Range. They are centuries old. They've been there forever. Another thing, in the movie Behind the Emerald Curtain, which is entertaining, though in many ways inaccurate, there are three different herbicides that are misspelled. These are, you know, anyone with a smartphone can check this in about 10 seconds, just as I did. But I wonder about the effort put into researching the information in that PR campaign. Another thing is they have a list of herbicides in that movie.
And please.
Duplication is very, there are four different duplicates there. So it makes it look like we're using a tremendous amount of herbicides in the forest. We're not.
The same ones. Thank you.
Okay, I'm Nancy Hathaway. I'm from Benton County, but I own property in five counties. My husband and I manage about 1,000 acres. One thing I heard this morning was that this bill is all about health and safety. Well, it may be about health and safety of Americans, but if the lumber industry is shut down, the forests are shut down, and we're unable to log, we'll be importing all our wood and paper products from countries that have less restrictive rules, so I guess they're not entitled to health and safety like we are. That doesn't sound very humanitarian to me. I also heard that this wasn't against small woodland owners, but just the industrial companies. Well, how many small woodland owners here own mills? I guess that'd be zero. I saw no hands up. So also, I'm opposed to the idea that any group can get together, kind of loosely written bill, and pass by a board that was appointed to look at these issues. What would happen if the AMA, American Medical Association, were overturned by a group of citizens who were not doctors or any medical profession and decided to set up their own rules? I think we need to go through the channels that are open to us, and that would be the Board of Forestry.
Thank you, Nancy. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. Dave Schmidt, thumbs down. Laura Harmson. Thumbs down. Ron Larson. Thumbs down. Dave Harmon.
This guy is having a flip. You've got him.
Please. Okay. Rick Barnes. Marsha Carr.
Sir, Chairman, yeah. I'm off the phone, so I'd like to be able to hang
up. Okay, we'll get you. Okay. And this is probably our last panel, then about 15 more people can just give us a thumbs down, maybe. I'll call all your names at that time.
No, he's going.
Please.
Chairman Clam, members of the committee, I'm Rick Barnes. I'm a small woodland owner, forestry consultant, and the current president of the Oregon Small Woodlands Association. Today I'm here testifying on behalf of the Oregon Small Woodlands Association and many of our members throughout the state. According to the OFRI publication, Oregon's private forest lands, where most timber harvest happens in the state, the amount of wood harvested each year is about 75% of the annual timber growth on these lands. We lose about 11% on these lands due to fire, insects, disease, etc., resulting in an annual increase in volume of about 14%. Due to our active management, the trees on private lands in this state are healthy and productive. The more trees grow, the more carbon dioxide is being converted to oxygen. The net growth is a tremendous benefit to global warming. If Oregonians want to learn about sustainability, I suggest they talk to the private landowners in this state. Many are living and working on properties that have been in their family for generations and or making plans for passing the property on to their generations.
Oh, thank
each
you.
Generation.
Sir, we've got to go to the next person. This
can
is
I finish
the red
paragraph,
light.
Please?
No. We're literally out of time already, so I've got to hear these two. Please.
Hi, I'm Dave Harmon. I'm manager of the Harmon Family LLC. We have about 700 acres of forest, small woodland and land in Clackamas County that my parents purchased in the 1960s. So while I'm a trained forester, had a career with the BLM as both wilderness manager and a managed forest manager, so I see the values in both preservation and management. But we've managed our property sustainably. We have a few small clear cuts, lots of commercial thinnings, trees that I planted when I was a kid we're harvesting now, and my boys helped me mark the timber. And I'm opposed to the bill because I think that we're doing everything we can now to pass it on to our kids and their grandchildren and our LLC, and the more I'm the only trained forester in the next family, we have a forest management plan that we've developed, but it'll be more and more difficult to maintain I think it'll be more of an incentive to sell for the non-foresters when they are faced with more and more regulation. Right now, it's not too difficult to figure out what to do, but this is just another layer coming on.
Thank you very much, ma'am.
My name is Marcia Carr. I'm representing Benton County Small Woodlands Owners. And my dad and mom worked really hard when I was growing up on the tree farm. They did not buy fancy things. They didn't take big vacations. They saved their money and invested it in timber property. They knew the trees would grow when it would be there for their retirement. With all these regulations, I looked through specific parts of this bill. Some of it, I did some research on the part that would affect us the most on one of our properties in LC. It's 160 acres. It would take away 20 to 30% of our property. If we took every seep, any little wet spot, they're considering to be that it would have to have a riparian area and a no-cut zone. It would take away 30 acres of our 160 acres would be absolutely no-cut. Another 20 acres would be we could thin lightly with a certain amount. But the main thing to me about this is the cost. Everything has a cost. And this bill starts off on line 21. He starts off saying that this is more job creation through more laborious forest practices. I think that sums up this whole bill. I think it's all about making more money, and I think it's about hiring more people. And that we just can't afford to pay that. And if we have to pay for a person to do our plan, we have to have a professional plan done. That's going to cost us thousands of dollars because that person has to be trained for this specific job.
Thank you, Marcia. Okay, sorry, everybody else. The room has to be used by somebody else, and all the committee members have other appointments. But I just want to say Scott Russell, Mike Barsotti, John Van De Corning, Bill Cluding, Dave Archambault, Jake Wilson, Daryl Lowe, William Henry, Audrey Barnes, Paul Bettis, Mark Schroeder, Luke Berge, Alan Fouch, Amanda Erickson, Greg Miller, Robert McNitt, Scott something with an H from Clackamas County, Jerome Rose, and Milt Noran. I know you're all thumbs down. You are all recorded for the record. If you have other written points you'd like to make, go ahead and email them to us. Or if you brought paper, hand them to us. It's all recorded for the record. I'm sorry we could not get to everybody. We just had a lot more people here than I was kind of expecting. And thank you for everybody being polite and attentive. And let's adjourn our committee. Holy cow. Thank you.